All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck, buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fuck, Nicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome. Welcome to it. How are you holding up? My heart goes out to people who lost people in the UK in that horrible event. And I, you know, and just everything else. Everything else. Today on the show, I have a conversation I had last week with Reza Aslan, the writer, theologian. Is that what you call it? He's a specializes in religions. Perhaps you know him. He's a frequent guest on news shows and other shows. He's written some great books. He's now the host and executive producer of the show Believer on CNN. It airs Sunday at 10 p.m. He was also a consulting producer on the HBO show The Leftovers, and you can pick up some of his books like No God But God and Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth, wherever you get books. Interesting talk. So I had Paul Rust here the other day, and he had brought up a thing that he did with me years ago. Now, I operate in, especially when I was doing radio, I was, in such a, I was in such a state of sort of exhaustion and panic and just some version of post-traumatic stress disorder that my memory is sort of shot from those times. But I talked to Brendan McDonald, my producer, and he went and found this radio bit. See, now back in the day when I had moved to LA after the Air America time and I was doing a nightly show out of KTLK, we had a working relationship with the UCB Theater to do comedy sketches with their students and performers. I didn't know a lot of them, but, we'd get referred them and they'd pitch stuff. So we found the bit. This was in March 2006, the first week that the Mark Maron show was on the air here in Los Angeles on KTLK, as I said. The bit happened over the course of it was a 2-hour show, and it was Paul calling in 4 different times with the idea being that we had a real-time movie reviewer, someone who would tell us how a movie was going as it was happening. That was the riff. That was the angle. So here it is. This is Paul Rust back in 2006 with me on the Mark Maron show. There's all 4 parts together. Listen, folks, it's Friday. It's a big movie night, and it's also just a couple of days away from the Oscars, so we thought we'd try something pretty revolutionary here to help satisfy the public's need for accurate, up-to-the-minute film criticism. Live on the phone, friends, from the Arclight Theater is our real-time movie reviewer, Paul Rust, who's going to conduct the world's first film review during the course of the movie. Paul, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. I'm right here in
the
theater.
Okay, what's going on?
Right now, the previews actually have just started, and there's a moment of anticipation in the air for the movie, Mark.
Sure. Y'all set up there at the theater?
Yeah. There's a preview right now for Failure to Launch, Matthew McConaughey vehicle, and looks pretty good.
All right, Paul. So why don't we let you get settled in, and we'll get back to you in a few minutes when you can give us a review of the first act. What are we going to be seeing? Do you have any idea?
We're going to be seeing the Oscar-nominated Good Night and Good Luck.
All right. Well, I appreciate you doing this, Paul. It's a revolutionary thing, and no one's ever done it before.
We're breaking new ground tonight, Mark.
You're telling me, man. So I'm looking forward to the As It Happens review. We'll get back to you. So hang tight and enjoy the movie.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, and try to be quiet.
Yes.
Okay, good. All right, so we'll check back in with Paul. That's going to be interesting. It's never been done before. All right, so folks, as you know, if you've been listening, we've got live on the phone right now from the Arclight Theater is our real-time movie reviewer, Paul Rust, who is going to be reviewing, what's it called again? The Good Night and Good Luck, the movie about Edward R. Murrow, as it unfolds. Paul, what's happening in the film, Paul?
Well, so far in Good Night and Good Luck, Edward R. Murrow has actually been forced to go undercover, get this, as an obese African-American woman. It's very funny.
Paul, it sounds like you're in the wrong theater, Paul. I think you're watching Big Mama's House 2. Is that possible?
Ah, Actually, yeah, now it makes sense why Edward R. Murrow kept saying, damn, girl.
All right, Paul, just get yourself into the right theater, and we'll call you back in a little while, okay?
Sounds good. Thank you, Mark.
Okay, all right, buddy, all right. Wow, that should...
he was in the wrong theater,
right? How long does it take to really realize that? You know what I mean? I mean, he's sitting there, and maybe he doesn't know who Edward R. Murrow is. Right now, we got a guy at the movies. We got our guy, Paul Rust, who is a real-time movie reviewer. We are breaking new ground on radio. He's at Good Night and Good Luck, and let's check in with him. Paul, what's happening in the film, my friend?
Well, right now, Edward R. Murrow, his uncle, yep, that's right, his uncle, he died.
What?
And now Murrow has to spend the night in a haunted house to inherit it. Yes.
What the hell are you talking about? I mean, I saw the movie. I don't remember that. I don't understand what you're talking about.
No, I said a large Sprite.
Okay. Wait a minute, Paul. Wait.
I said a large Sprite.
Paul,
what?
You're at the concession stand. Come on, man. You're supposed to be the movie guy.
Okay, Mark. The movie's pretty boring, okay? And I just wanted some Sour Patch Kids.
Well, so how long are you spending out there? You're just making stuff up now? I mean, can you just get your food and go back in the movie and let's try and pull this together and get a good close on this thing? Because we want to do this again, Paul.
It's very boring. Yes, I can give it a shot.
Just go finish the film and we'll call you in a few, I guess we'll get back to you in about 15 minutes to find out how it ends and see if we can close this up with a little juice, all right?
Can I bring the Sour Patch Kids?
I don't know what movie theater. Yeah, you can. You're allowed to eat in the theater. Come
on. Thank you.
Okay, buddy. I'll talk to you in a minute. Man, I thought that was going to work out so much better. He can't even watch the whole damn movie. Let's check back in with our buddy Paul Rust, who's down there at the ArcLight. He's doing an in theater review of Good Night and Good Luck. Paul, what's happening, Paul?
Mark, I know I should be quiet, but this movie is too exciting, okay?
Oh,
it says Edward R. Murrow has just been demoted, okay?
Yeah.
And him and Fred Friendly are not happy about this.
Uh-huh.
In fact, they are quite disenchanted. Yeah. Shut up. What? Shut up. You're ruining the movie. Okay, hey, this is a free country, buddy, okay? Don't try to censor me.
All right.
Censor me, you McCarthyite.
All right.
I'm a Murrow here, baby.
All right. All right, Paul. Paul, maybe I get out of theater there before you get hurt. How would that be?
Maybe.
So the movie really picked up, and I'm glad you got excited. It sounds very compelling. I think you made it really interesting for everybody.
Yeah, Mark, I'm not one for hyperbole, but this movie is blowing my mind.
All right, man. Well, thank you for doing the first Mark Maron Show real-time movie review, Paul. We'll try it again later.
Thank you.
Okay, buddy. Take care.
You too.
So there you go. That was a little blast from the past. Me, improvising with Paul Rust on a phoner sketch. That music, by the way, if you're wondering, we used there was by the Tomorrow Men. So now I've got Reza Aslan coming up, and it's another interesting thing. Back when I was doing morning radio, he would also call in, and I remind him of that. He was sort of the go-to guy for Muslim-related news on some level. I never met him face-to-face, and it was exciting to talk to him in person because it was a talk about faith, about religion, about his new show, which I watched a few episodes of and I liked. And I'm somebody that doesn't have a real religion in place. I don't have a God in place. I go in and out of faith. I do tend to find a lot of, reprieve in doing this and doing stand-up and playing guitar and being creative and trying to, have conversations with people and connect with people. But faith is interesting. And, it was a very sort of deep and personal conversation that we had about a lot of stuff, ranging from intellectual things to things in his life, growing up Muslim here in America from Iranian parents who left Iran. And it was a conversation I've never had before. So, we're going to talk to him in a minute. Sometimes these conversations I've been having lately have just been great. I really enjoyed the Louis Theroux I like talking to Paul Rust, and you know, sometimes these conversations, like same with Louie, that me and Reza, it becomes a real sort of intellectual but emotional conversation about things that are, you know, really significant to most people. And, you know, when I get engaged in one of these conversations, it's very exciting for me, not in a way that, well, I'm not necessarily learning about another person, but you're sort of, you know, kicking around ideas that pressure you to engage in what those ideas really mean. And in this conversation, it was faith and religion, belief, and also talking to somebody with a profoundly different life experience for me, and a life experience that I think is relevant in the world we live in now, where everything is polarized and really being broken down into very black and white type of arguments, which is just never the case with human beings. So let's go now to me and Reza Aslan. He's now the producer and host of Believer on CNN. It airs Sundays at 10 p.m. And as I said, you can pick up his books like No God But God and the controversial Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. Smart guy. And my neighbor. This is me and Reza Aslan. You know, we used to talk to you a lot. I've talked to you before.
I think we have.
No, I know I have. I used to be the morning show guy on Air America, and we used to call you a lot.
That's right.
On Morning Sedition, we talked to you fairly frequently.
Man, that's like 10 years ago or something.
More.
Right? Yeah.
It's like 13 years ago.
13 years ago.
Right. You were one of the go-to jihadi guys.
Yeah, right.
Like, we need some information on this Al-Qaeda business.
All things.
Let's get
things,
Reza on the line.
Islam. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so you've been doing this beat for a while. Beat, not a pundit, but you're a scholar of religion, and you covered the Muslim beat.
Yeah.
So you were like a guy that people you know knew, but so you've been getting death threats since then.
Yeah, I mean, look, pretty much since I've been in the public eye, I've been getting death threats.
From whom? I imagine from Muslims as well as...
It runs the gambit. So it depends. Like, you know, when I first started and I wrote my first book about Islam, which is No God But God, I got a lot of death threats from kind of extremist Muslim groups who thought that I was, you know, heretical in the way that I was describing Islam. But I also got like a lot of death threats from extremist Jewish and Christian groups, you know, who were basically, you're just an Islamic apologist, you know.
But the angle of that book was really seeking some sort of moderate dialogue.
Well, it was just basically like a popular introduction to Islam in all of its diversity, but
right.
it was clearly critical
right.
of some of the more sort of fundamentalist readings,
yeah.
you know, and it was
yeah.
an attempt to bring some kind of, you know, understanding and
yeah. Right.
some sense of, you know, moderate voice to it.
Well, I think that like in these areas and also with the new CNN show, like your empathy and, you know, willingness and your diplomatic disposition, you know, it leaves you vulnerable.
It does. And listen, I know it's religion, right? People tend to take that kind of seriously.
Right.
You
do
know?
You?
I mean, I take religion seriously in the sense that, you know, I value people's beliefs. I value faith. I recognize the good and the bad that religion has had on society, you
right.
know, throughout history. I understand that it is deeply a part of the human experience, that like literally it is a part of our evolution as Homo sapiens. You
well,
know, we
right.
can trace it all the way back to the beginning.
Yeah, yeah, to the first little etchings.
Yeah, but I also recognize that it's a man-made thing, right? And I mean man-made, like literally man-made, like people with penises.
Yeah.
And as a result, like any man-made thing, it's flawed. Like you're supposed to be able to pick out its critical parts.
Now.
Praise it for what it's good and, you know.
I imagine now, you know, in retrospect, now that you have a large menu of religions to pick from that have, you know, some have succeeded, some have failed, some have mutated, some, like you talk a little bit in the show about, have gone many different directions within their
yep.
religion. But I think initially, the idea, if you go back to the primitive beings, that, you know, there weren't too many critics. I because they still had to explain why it was raining.
Right.
Why didn't the crops grow? You know, no one's yeah. You take it up with God.
Yeah.
But you know, don't shit on the shaman.
Right,
that'll
exactly.
only get you in trouble.
That's true. I would love to kind of go back there and see, like, you know, the shaman debates. You know, it's like,
I don't know if there were ones. I think that the yeah. shaman was one of the original spin masters.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, it's funny that you bring that up, because what's really fascinating is that religion doesn't become an institution until, like, really the time of the Mesopotamians. So let's say, if we're being generous, like 6,000 or 7,000 BC.
Yeah.
But religious expression confidently
yeah.
can be traced to about 120, 150,000 years ago.
Right.
And I think with a little less confidence, but I think still with some measure of, you know, confidence, can be traced even further, maybe 200, 300, even 400,000 years ago.
Well, I'm sort of fascinated, not so much with religion per se, but with the need to believe. Like, you yeah. know, one of the most important books, and I've talked about it a lot on this show, is The Denial of Death, Ernest Becker's
mm-hmm,
book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which really blew my mind, in that what he posits is that the need to believe, to feel part of something bigger than yourself on some level, to define your life and fight the existential terror of knowing our own mortality, is almost genetic.
It is genetic. And in fact, when I talk about material evidence for religion, I'm yeah. talking about burial grounds. That's uh-huh. what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I mean, like, there's a lot of debate about how far back you can go, and whether, like, some of the, you know, we found idols that are 300, 400,000 years old. And is that expression of religion, or is it just some dude who was, like, carving
the Willendorf Venus?
Out of a rock. Exactly. Yeah. Mm. And so the Barakat Ram Venus, among all the different Venuses, the Barakat Ram Venus, which is probably the oldest. It's like this little lump of rock that somebody, a Neanderthal, somebody carved into the shape of a kind of a fat, naked yeah. woman. And so some scholars would be like, wow, that's the first expression, you know, the earliest expression of religiosity. And others are like, no, that's just like Neanderthal porn.
Right.
You know?
Like, yeah.
So
he was going
knows?
On a long walk.
Yeah, exactly.
He's going to be out for a few days.
He needed to take that with
yeah,
him.
Yeah, his little masturbation totem.
Literally, that's what people have said. And so technically we don't know, and either answer is good, really.
But
yeah. if we're talking about absolutely unanimously defined religious expression,
yeah.
we're talking about burial grounds, and we can go back about 120,000 years.
That is the sanctity of the dead, in terms of it having implications that there was a ritual around it, so there was perhaps a belief of something that happens after.
It's actually a pretty simple formula, right? I mean, there is no reason to bury a dead person.
Well, you don't want it just hanging around.
No, you do. You absolutely do. You just dump a dead person outside, and some beast comes and takes it away. It's as
yeah.
simple as that. It's
yeah, but then you
got to
see your brother, parts of him down the street. You know, like
right. yeah.
Like I know cats; they don't eat everything, and you're going to come upon something. It's kind of jarring.
But I will say that, like, the idea of putting together the effort, and this
yeah.
is what they would do. This is a fairly standard, you know, practice. They would dig a hole. They would usually fill the hole with flowers or, like, bits of metal, tools,
yeah.
things that the living person had or cherished.
Right.
They would put the living person in there. They would often cover him in this, like, red ochre.
Yeah.
They would put the living person in there, usually in some sort of pose, you know, facing the sun
yeah.
often. Then they would bury it. They would put a rock there. They would come and visit it.
Yeah.
They would light fires around it. Occasionally, they would then disinter the body, cut
yeah.
off the head,
mm-hmm.
And then, you know, put some plaster and some seashells on it, and then, you know, put the head up. The point is that all of that indicates that
yeah.
at the very least, these ancient peoples thought that this wasn't it.
Right.
So this argument that it all began because of death is not a bad argument.
Right. Well, yeah, the terror, the fear, the, you know, the need to
control.
Know that the, yeah, I mean, I can see that, but I also feel that, you know, maybe since day one, you know, life was, oh, the one thing you knew about life, it was fairly miserable. So how do you, you know, infuse hope, you know, into people? How does a leader infuse hope? You know, like, well, this isn't it. You know, I know it sucks here, But you know, but this isn't it.
Right.
Right? I guess that's control.
Yeah, it's a little bit of it's control. It's trying to maintain some sense of control over the nature and the way that the universe functions. Yeah. That has a lot to do with it. But I think there's something more fundamental, because if religion is part of human evolution, and it is, there's no question about that, then it has to adhere to the laws of evolution. In other words, there has to be an adaptive advantage for it to have arisen and for it to have continued. The problem is that
can be interpreted. That's so broad. You know, how anybody sees evolution in religious terms could either be horrendously fascistic or the opposite.
Well, but it doesn't. But that's the important thing. It doesn't become fascistic until much, much later.
No, I get it. But I could see, you know, even on a tribal level, that, you know, if you have a couple of different gods, that, you know, that's fighting words.
Yes, but this is even before there are gods.
Oh.
This is what I'm saying, is that we're talking about the core, the origin of the religious impulse, before it actually expresses itself in rituals, before it expresses itself in, like, identifying a god.
So what is that impulse? Like, duh, this is it?
That's it. That's exactly it. The impulse is this it?
Yeah.
That's the impulse.
Right.
So how does that, if that really is the impulse, the question that I think scientists and historians and anthropologists and everybody, what can't be answered is why?
Yeah.
Why? How does that actually help you adapt? And there's a bunch of answers to this, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, it seems pretty clear to me that, like,
tell me your idea and I will shoot it down.
Oh, no. I mean, belief is a powerful thing, that, you know, if you have like-minded people that believe, you know, a common idea, there's no end to what can be done. And also there's no end to how it can, you know, build a family, build community, build things,
right?
You know, pursue common interests, you know, protection. I mean, you know, it's a way of grounding a community.
So that's the oldest argument for why religion exists.
Is it
goes
bad?
All the way to Durkheim. It makes perfect sense, because you think to yourself, well, sure. I mean, religion is about communal building. And if you are in a community that is bound together by, like, shared ideas and shared symbols, naturally it's going to give you an adaptive advantage to a community that doesn't. Here's the problem.
Uh-huh.
Number one, religion is, by definition, not inherently a communal thing. It's as much exclusive as it is inclusive. It's as much about people who don't belong as it is about people who do belong. So, for instance, if you are going to say, we bind ourselves together according to this symbol, whatever the symbol symbol means. So this is even before belief, right?
Right.
So what you have to say is that there are those among us who accept those symbols and those who don't.
Right.
And so far from actually creating a necessarily cohesive group, it can do just as much in separating a group together, creating divisions within a group as inclusion within
a group. There's still a couple of groups left. I would imagine that the people that are necessarily singled out, if they're individuals, are either ostracized or made shamans.
Well, so the issue here is, of course, does it have a uniquely adaptive advantage?
Uh-huh.
So it doesn't, not just for that reason, but also because the truth of the matter is that while religion, you can make an argument that religion is cohesive, it is not uniquely cohesive. In fact, kinship is the single most cohesive element in ancient social groups.
Family.
So in other words, a cave, you know, the people in your cave were not there because they all shared a similar belief system.
Yeah.
They were there because they were related in some blood, blood
way. But then you start having parties, you know. Neighbors come over.
But here's the problem again, is that it sounds like it makes perfect sense. And certainly once you get to institutionalized religion, which is 100,000 years later, you can make an argument for that. But if you're talking about why did it arise among people in caves, that falls flat. So another argument is,
But what we're talking about then, though, you know, to get more heady and then we'll get back down to earth, is that, you know, you're not talking about religion with the same qualities. You know, you're
talking about belief. Yeah.
Yeah. But you're also talking about
impulse. Yeah.
But also, like, what you're considering religion, the reason they didn't hold up was at some point they realized, you know, either there were too many gods, or that animal didn't do what it was supposed to do, or that isn't bad luck, or whatever the symbols or belief systems are, wore out, right?
Well, it's a long time before we get to
that. I know, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. So, like, to even call them, you know, religions is difficult.
That's true.
And because they didn't survive.
And by the way, that's why I'm not saying religion. I'm saying the religious impulse.
Okay.
Like, the human impulse toward religious belief.
Okay.
How did that arise in human evolution?
Well, it didn't seem to me in the show that was really a theme.
No. I mean, look, Believer is about me immersing myself in the lived experience of these different religious groups who are on the margins the fringes, who are misunderstood or misrepresented.
It's a little uncomfortable in places.
It's very uncomfortable in places,
Let me talk to you. Where did you come from?
I was born in Iran.
Like, in what year? Like, you're younger than me.
72.
So it was, it was getting shitty there.
Yeah, I mean, I lived through essentially a religious revolution.
The Khomeini regime.
Yeah, yeah.
And you were how old?
Destroyed my country. I was 7 years old.
And you remember that happening?
Oh, I remember it very clearly. Yeah, I mean, we fled for our lives afterwards.
What position was your father in that required fleeing?
Well, my dad wasn't. I mean, he had communist tendencies. He was a rabid atheist.
An intellectual. What did he do?
He did nothing, basically. He came from a fairly wealthy family, big landowning family, lots of a huge legacy.
So those are usually,
are the guys to go.
Yeah, once they get grounded, those are the guys that, we need that land.
We need that land. We need your home. We need
all
your
heritage.
Exactly. And I think
he felt that coming.
He felt it coming very early on. In fact, I think his idea, because he was always so anti-religious anyway. My dad was the kind of guy who, always had a pocket full of Prophet Muhammad jokes that he would pull out
right.
in inappropriate times,
right.
Get him at
killed
parties.
Now.
Yeah, and he looked around and he thought, oh, no. Like,
no more jokes.
Yeah, I gotta get the hell out of this. And I think he thought that it would just be a temporary thing, I mean, we basically left everything behind and came to the States with nothing. And then,
really?
And then next thing Khomeini took complete control and Iran became essentially an Islamic theocracy.
So what happened to the land? What happened to the money?
It's gone. The land is gone. The money is gone. Yeah. All those major estates were all broken up and then they were given to, either religious foundations or these corrupt, mullahs.
So before, forgive me for my lack of knowledge about Iranian politics, but, Khomeini followed the Shah, right?
Yeah.
That was it. What they were fighting against.
I mean, we went from an oppressive secular dictatorship to an oppressive religious dictatorship.
Right. And for people like your dad, the secular dictatorship was a little more comfortable.
Well, it was more beneficial to him.
Sure.
Right? I mean, look, the revolution, part of why it succeeded so well is because that it was in the name of the lower classes and the poor and the people who
yeah, I'm feeling a little of that.
Have. Yeah, exactly. Right. It kind of feels familiar.
I think we're all feeling a little of that.
Which, by the way, is an argument that I make all the time that I think Americans, in their overconfidence, just simply, dismiss. Like, I grew up in a country that was one thing one day and something entirely different the next. I understand how easy that transformation takes place.
Yeah, and also a lot of people grow up in authoritarian countries.
Yeah.
Most people on the planet.
Most of the world, exactly, is authoritarian. And now I think a lot of Americans, even those on the left who are rabidly against Trump and this, fascist administration, even they have this confidence in the fact that, hey, we've been a democracy for like 240 years, man. That means it's permanent.
Yeah.
It's like, man.
It's infancy.
I mean, one 9/11 style attack under this administration and we are fucked. It's over.
Great.
It's over. This is an administration that will, go to its grave lying about the most useless shit possible. How many people showed up at its inauguration? What kind of lies do you think this administration will put forth, when we are under some kind of existential attack in this country? This is an administration that, citing no evidence whatsoever, wants to ban Muslims from the United States. Imagine if there's a terror attack.
Right.
You know, this is an administration that has repeatedly said not only are they going to keep Guantanamo Bay open, but they want to start sending American citizens to
fill it. Fill it up.
Yeah, fill it up.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And what's funny is that they keep saying stuff like this, and we all just keep saying, well, that's a horrible thing to say, but, you know, we're not going to take it seriously, but take this man seriously.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And okay. So when you guys flee, I'm taking it seriously. Yeah, I was trying to have a good day. It's harder and harder. but when you guys flee, where do you go?
We actually first ended up in Oklahoma.
Really?
Yeah, my dad had like sometime in college done like a study abroad semester in Enid, Oklahoma, or something like that.
That's a pretty low budget study abroad there.
Yeah, tell me about it. And then I think when it was time to like flee and come to America, he just was like, "Well,
that's all he knew."
I think he just assumed Oklahoma was America.
Yeah, it is.
Which, by the way, yeah, he was absolutely right.
Yeah, it's very America.
We were in America. We were in Oklahoma for a little while. It didn't take that long for us to realize that there's more to America.
Right, right. This can't be it.
This can't be it.
That was your religious moment. Yes. About America.
That's right.
Is this it?
So we got
it's weird. You don't hear a lot about Oklahoma.
We got on the car and just headed west. And we ended up in the Bay Area. And that seemed more like it.
Well, yeah.
Like, oh, yeah.
Well, definitely a diverse culture. It's a bit, what part of the Bay Area?
San Jose. Well, San Jose, of course, was full of Mexican immigrants. This is before, you know, the big, Silicon Valley boom when it was just like mostly, you know, vineyards and things like that. And it was perfect for me because this is like 1980. It's during the Iran hostage crisis. You know, it's like a time in which everybody is, you know, I mean, so much anti-Iranian sentiment, so much anti-Muslim sentiment. I'm like 7 years old trying to not be weird, surrounded by all these Mexican immigrants. So I was like, yeah, I'm Mexican. I was just like, what's up, bato? I'm Mexican. I learned how to break dance.
Yeah. You could pass a little.
I could pass a little
bit. Did you learn Spanish?
Yeah. I mean, you have no choice. Like you're surrounded right by Spanish speakers. So I just started speaking Spanish and people would be like, where are you from? And I'd be like, I'm from Mexico, orale. I would just end every sentence with orale.
But did you actually become conversational in Spanish?
No, hell no. No, you couldn't
do it.
But what's funny is neither could these kids because they were all born
in America.
Right. So we all had that same, you know, sense of, you know, like dispossession.
Now, what was the feeling in the house? How many brothers and sisters you got?
I had one sister who was born in Iran and came with us, and then one sister who was born in America.
Now, so like, what is the household during the 80s? Is your father watching TV and thankfully got out, or mad or concerned about, you know, property? I mean, like, what was the tension in the house? Where did he land, you know, in terms of occupation and things?
I mean, my dad, who just recently passed, basically like died like with like a bitter, you know, like I think the last words on his mouth was like, goddamn mullahs,
He,
you know, that's pretty standard for like that generation of Iranians who came to the United States. I mean, it's like this profound like anti, you know, mullah hatred. I mean, these were the guys who like voted for George W. Bush. These were the guys who voted for Trump even. I mean, if my dad were alive right now, he would be like, I don't know, that Trump, he's got some good ideas,
yeah,
you know, like Muslim ban. I agree. You know, I don't want any Muslims in America. And especially like, you know, my wife's family, like, this is great. Like, no more Iranians coming to America. This is fantastic.
Your mother?
My mom's family.
Was more religious?
A little more religious than my dad's family.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting dynamic. Right. Like, I mean, I had to imagine that must have fueled some of your interest.
Totally. And in fact, when we were in the States now, for my dad, it was like, this is great. I don't have to pretend I'm a Muslim anymore like I did in Iran. And for my mom, like, she still very much wanted us to, you know, maintain our, you know, our cultural heritage in the house,
But
like,
we were
told very clearly, when you leave this house, you do not tell anyone that you're Iranian or you're Muslim. Like, you just keep that shit to yourself.
Well, that's interesting because that's not unlike any, you know, I don't know necessarily religious subculture that immigrated at any time, where, you know, it might have taken a generation to integrate.
Absolutely.
That it's interesting to me that you grew up, you know, which is something you don't hear because the dialogue is so, you know, charged, that, you know, this idea that someone like your father, who is by birth a Muslim but ultimately doesn't give a shit, exists.
Exactly. Which, this is the funny thing, is I think that's, people need to realize that that's a sort of fundamental fact of the entire world.
With religion.
Yeah, you know, Americans have this such skewed idea about, you know, not just everybody else, but religion in particular.
Yeah.
You know, like I love hearing people like Mike Huckabee or, you know, Newt Gingrich, these like devout Christian nationalists,
yeah,
who are like, we need to change the Constitution so that it is in alignment with the Bible. We have to, you know, outlaw sodomy because, you know, God said so. And then you're like, hey, how do you feel about the Muslim Brotherhood? And they're like, theocrats!
Yeah.
Those people want a, you know, religious state. And it's like, dude, what, you just hear what you just said?
Right.
You know?
Well, that, but this is our guys.
This is, yeah, this is
those
our guys.
Are the bad guys.
Yeah, yeah. I meant my God, yeah, not their God.
Yeah, yeah. But when did you start realizing this? I mean, you know, like, you know, in your childhood, you have this, your father who, you know, what did he end up doing is for a job?
So when he was like a rich kid in Iran, he went and got a degree in accounting because he figured, oh, I got to do something.
Yeah.
And then when he came to America, he's like, oh, shit, I have to be an accountant now. And so he spent, you know, almost 40 miserable years as an accountant and like hated every minute of it.
But he provided and you guys grew
Absolutely.
Up well. And
yeah, yeah, you know, yeah. I mean, you know, we're pretty poor, but yeah.
He was miserable?
He provided. He hated his job. He hated every minute of his job.
Was he always running around yelling?
He did yell a lot, but it's mostly like grumbling, like, yeah. God damn it.
Yeah, yeah.
God damn mullahs. God damn it.
Accounting. Goddamn numbers.
But let me tell you something. This is the funny thing about him, is that I don't know if you know Iranians, but
only a couple.
There is a very deeply embedded cultural tradition in Iran called Taaruf.
Uh-huh.
And this is, it's really hard for Americans to understand this.
Yeah.
The best way that I can define it is that it's like insincere deference. It's like a game of chicken that Iranians play with each other about who can lower himself the most, uh-huh. right? So, and it takes many forms. So, for instance, you know, about like picking up a check at a restaurant. Like, you know, everyone argues about picking up a check at a restaurant, but Iranians, like, it'll become a knife fight.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I've seen my dad, you know, basically wrestle people to the ground
over wanting to pay the check.
Yeah. If someone compliments you of something. If I was like, hey, Mark, that's a nice watch. Your job is to say,
no,
this
not.
Watch is yours.
Oh, right.
It's yours. You just take it off and you just hand it over.
Is that a humility thing? What is that?
It's fake humility.
Oh.
So the problem is that everyone in Iran, because again, this is, it's like the foundation of what it means to be Iranian,
yeah.
is this kind of fake deference thing.
Yeah.
Everyone in Iran knows this, and it's a game that we all play. We don't even take it all that seriously.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Like, I went to Iran once, and I was negotiating over some trinket that I wanted to buy.
Yeah.
And, like, I'm negotiating for, like, 10 minutes, and it's like, you know, 50 cents, no, 40 cents, no, 47 cents, 42 cents. Finally, we settle on it. And I'm like, okay, fine, 45 cents. And then the guy says, oh, I can't take your money. No, I can't. I can't do that. Now, while he's saying, I can't take your money, he's filling out the receipt.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And while I'm saying, no, I insist, I'm handing over the money.
Yeah.
It's just a game.
Yeah.
Here's the problem. Americans don't know how to play the game.
Yeah.
So what happens all the time, and every Iranian has a story like this, is that Iranians come to America, they instinctively play the Taaruf game.
Yeah.
And the American guy doesn't play along. So it's like, hey, that's a nice watch. Oh, this watch, it's yours. Oh, thanks, man.
Yeah,
they take the watch.
Yeah.
So my dad, you know, he's an accountant. He starts getting clients, right? The clients come in. He does all the work for them. And they say, you know, how much do I owe you? And my dad instinctively says, nothing. I can't take your money. And the client goes, holy shit, thanks, man.
Yeah, yeah.
So we would never get paid.
He kept doing it. See, that? I mean, I guess that's one of the arguments to integrate, you know, yeah, fully into
quickly.
The culture.
Integrate quickly. You know, he would occasionally accept gifts. Like, I'd come home and there'd be a vacuum cleaner. And I'd be like, what's that? You know, like,
but
my
he
client
must have been the most
vacuum.
Popular accountant in San Jose.
Yeah, especially in the immigrant community. You know,
with Mexicans or
Mexicans and Filipinos and you know everybody.
No Iranians because they know they'd have to pay.
Yeah, exactly. The Iranians, exactly. That they never worked with other Iranians.
So, like, when do you like? So, but you are brought up with some Quran education. Quran.
No. Literally, we came to America, and it was like we had divorced ourselves from like it was like we stripped our house clean of any signs of Islam.
Out of fear or desire?
Out of fear. Well, from my dad's point, it was like, ha ha, freedom.
Finally.
I don't have to keep pretending.
Yeah.
But, you know, from my mom's point, it was very much an issue of safety, right? Like, she would sometimes pray, but, like, quietly and in a corner. You know, no one was looking.
So she held on to it.
She holds on to it to this day.
Right.
It's been, like, 40 years, and I swear to God, to this day.
Yeah.
Like, if I'm on CNN, you know, saying something about, you know, Trump, my mom will call me afterwards and be like, what are you doing? Keep your mouth shut. They're going to take you away.
Yeah.
And I'm like, Mom, that's like not a thing.
Not yet.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I used to be able to say confidently, Mom, this isn't Iran.
Yeah,
that's not what happens.
Right.
Nowadays, I'm not so sure, actually.
Yeah.
You know, I think she's got a point.
But I think it's interesting that, you know, what seems to temper your exploration of religion is this idea that you're not... I think you're empathetic to the individuals involved, yet you understand the potential, danger.
Yes.
So, you know, and it seems to come primarily from the balance of your childhood that, you know, there are two ways. Like, there is the birthright of religion, and you sort of passively say, yeah, I'm Muslim, yeah, I'm Jewish, I'm Catholic. And, you know, what you don't think, like, you know, Catholics and a lot of Jews are sort of like, yeah, but I don't go anywhere. I went when I was a kid. I went, but for some reason, a lot of people don't think Muslims ever say that.
I know.
And you know, obviously, by talking to you now, of course, you know, when there's a billion, however many Muslims, they can't all be. You know.
I mean, it's so logical, right? Like,
who the hell?
Nobody in their right mind thinks that all billion and a half Christians think the same
way.
Right,
but that's a human thing. That is the human. That is the sort of weird.
It's tribalism.
It's tribalism, right? But there's this like this idea that you got a group of people, you know, human beings. You know, the percentages of the people that are going to be, you know, compulsively fanatical is very small to the people that are like, all right, you know,
exactly
those guys
and loud,
yeah, right. But just it's just human nature to be like, I got a life. Well, yeah, am I going to pray 9 times a day?
I know, but it's so funny. It's so fascinating, too, because of that whole argument, because you hear all the time, like, how come we don't hear from moderate Muslims? It's like, because we're in the fucking grocery store. Like, what do you want? You know, how come when, like, Robert Deere shot up at Planned Parenthood last year, I didn't hear a bunch of Christians, like, on TV being like, that's not really Christianity. Why? Because they were minding their own damn business.
Yeah.
You know? And it's the same thing for people of all faiths.
Yeah.
And listen... I am constantly being assailed by extreme adherence to religions, you know, whether it's like radical Hindus who hate me because of believer or radical Muslims who hate me because of, you know, whatever. I get so many death threats from radical Christians. Actually, this is a absolute truth. The worst that I get it from, the worst sort of threats and anger and just by numbers and sheer volume is from radical atheists. They're the ones that I'm like most often like, Jesus.
Why? Because you're too sympathetic?
Yeah. That I even take religion seriously at all, you know, I take belief seriously at all.
But, you know, there is an element to the show that, you know, I think you're approaching these subjects in earnest and in a vulnerable way. That, you know, where are you with belief? What did so you were passive as a Muslim and you just remained that way your whole life?
No, I mean, look, you said it perfectly before, is that personal experience of seeing the power that religion has to do
being run out of your
tremendous
country.
To do tremendous good and bad.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, that's the important thing, right? I mean, the same Christianity that gave us the civil rights movement gave us Trump.
Yeah.
Okay, so I get it.
Yeah.
It can be good or bad depending on how it's used.
How the people are guided, how the people are led,
right.
How the belief is exploited
and expressed,
and what level of desperation is driving their intent.
That fascinated me even as a little kid.
Because of the fanatics.
Yeah, but I never had an opportunity to actually do anything about it. Because, again, like, my household was like, no more religion in this house.
Yeah.
When I was in high school, I had some friends who went to this evangelical youth group.
Yeah.
And I went with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard the gospel story, and I was like, whoa, this is the most amazing thing I've ever heard in my entire life. Like, wait, hold on. The God of heaven and earth came down in the form of a baby, and then like grew up and died for our sins, and all we got to do is believe in him, and we go to heaven. That's the greatest thing I've ever heard in my entire life. And
in
also,
high school. Wow, you were lost.
I was. Well, but also the other thing too is that, and you know, I didn't recognize this at the time. I understand it much more today, but that was my America ID card, right?
Yeah.
Like, what, Jesus is your entry card into America. Like, once you accept Jesus in your heart,
yeah,
your skin color doesn't matter anymore. Your ethnicity doesn't matter anymore. Like, the accent you speak with doesn't matter.
So
like,
you're
in
high school and you go this thing and you're surrounded by a lot of different types of people.
No, just white people.
Just white people. Yeah. But they were sort of like, well, what do you want to...
They were like, do you want to accept Jesus into your heart and be one of us? And I was like, hell yes, I do.
And you believed?
Yeah, and I don't want to make it sound like it was cynical, because again, I mean, I was like 15. I didn't understand.
No, but even now, you know, as a person who is vulnerable and as a person who, you know, is, you know, non-religious in any way, you know, but still fraught with, you know, fear and a certain lack of, emotional and spiritual stability, and somebody who intellectually understands how that is provided by these systems, you know, I still resist it, because I think as you get older, your capacity for suspending your disbelief diminishes unless shit gets real bad.
Yeah.
So I guess, you know, my question is, what was it essentially in talking about that religious moment or that question, that primal question in that moment, you as that kid, you know, outside of, you know, backloading becoming American, what was it in you that bought it? You know, even in these shows, I see that you're still vulnerable to it, yet you have a sort of boundary, but you still allow yourself to immerse yourself and experience the feelings. But, you know, in the show, what became clear to me after watching four or five of them was that, all right, you're open to it and you're engaging in it and you're saying, yeah, that felt this way or this felt that way, but you're not gonna, you know, midway through the series go like, yeah, I'm gonna just stay with the voodoo people.
Right.
The commitment.
It's really, you're bringing up something so good right now. I've never actually made this connection before. It's like, I feel like I should pay you for like therapy, but yeah, there was that feeling of belonging, going back to the purpose of religion, right?
With the Christian thing.
Yeah, there was that feeling. It's like, wow, I belong. Like,
yeah.
Nobody questions me anymore. Like,
yeah.
I am one of you now.
Right.
Because, like, Jesus is your, like, welcome to America card.
Right.
But there was also, I think that experience was interesting because it taught me to value faith, which I still do. And hopefully in the show, you get that. You get that I value these people's faiths.
A fault almost.
Some people would say, like, I'm totally open to your faith. I may think it's a little bit bizarre, but, you know, I'm going to be open to it. I'm not going to come to you with judgment. Okay?
Right.
At the same time, though, it wasn't long in my sort of Christian, and this was, a very conservative evangelical Christian group. It wasn't long before they were like, also gays are going to hell. And also the Bible says you can't have sex. And I was like, wait, what?
Yeah.
And I'm the kind of guy, and I've always been this guy, where like, I'm not going to just take your word for it. So
right.
I would, you know, go home and I would open up the Bible and I'd be like, wait, where does it say you're not supposed to have sex before marriage? Because it literally does not say that anywhere from Genesis to Revelation. Wait, where does it say that? Like,
how could it have said that for them to populate the world like that? All those people, they lived 900 years and they had 200
Come on,
kids.
Man. You know, all this stuff that I was told that the Bible says, I would go in and I'd be like, wait, it doesn't say that. And then I would go back to church and I'd be like, excuse me.
The Iranians here.
The brown guy has a question in the back. It doesn't actually say that.
Yeah.
And what I thought would happen is a conversation.
Right.
And instead, they would sort of lay hands on me. and try to kind of remove the doubt. And I was like, this is not working for me. But the irony is, at the same time, I valued the faith, but started becoming critical of religion.
Right,
that,
right.
That has been essentially that's my calling card, you know, where I'm like, I understand religion is something made by human beings. I understand the flaws of it. I get the institutional aspects of it, the way that it can be, you know, towards good and to bad.
Okay.
But I also value that people have faith.
Yeah,
they,
I know,
that
but
they believe
faith,
these things.
It seems like you can separate that, you know, faith in and of itself. It doesn't require belief on some level. So I mean, there is a bit of a chasm there.
I don't know. I respect faith. I actually don't think of them all that separately. Like, in other words, I don't think, for instance, you know, I get a lot of people, you know, I have referred to atheism as a belief system, and mm-hmm. I get a lot of shit for that.
Well, I've done that too, yeah. that there is a dogma to it.
There is absolutely a dogma to it. I mean, it's predicated upon certain, like, postulates and hypotheses about the nature of the universe, much of which is impossible to prove, and yet a great amount of it, you know, is sort of taken in this sort of gospel way.
Well, I mean, the arguments there are really about reason, and there is I don't want to say a cynicism to it, but there is a need to hold a line at reason.
And I couldn't agree more.
Right.
But I think it's incorrect to say that religious belief is by definition irrational or unreasonable. Yes, a lot of it is, but it need not be.
Yeah, but I mean, but religious belief, especially in the culture we live in now and seeing how, you know, mutated and malignant it can become, where, you know, there's something about the American way, and I think there's something about the way of people that, you know, the nature of hucksterism requires belief. So the nature of sales requires belief, that to be sold on something is probably just as ancient as the organized religions. So it becomes this weird thing that to criticize belief in and of itself is to criticize, you know, oddly, capitalism.
Well, and you said it perfectly in that there isn't anything unique about religious belief that sets it apart from these other forms of belief that you're talking about.
Other than a transcendent faith.
But that's the thing, is that people will say, oh, but religious belief, you know, carries with it a certain amount of absolutism.
Right.
And it's like, well, yes, so does patriotism and nationalism.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, right. America right or wrong, right? You know, love it or leave it. You know, that kind of devout belief in American exceptionalism is as often absurdly applied as the most evangelical versions or fundamentalist versions of religion.
But the payoff is to be part of something that transcends your own life.
That transcends your own identity. That's right. That gives you
I'm willing to die for this. So,
be it patriotism
or Jesus, whatever.
Or Jesus.
Sure.
Or your race or ethnicity.
Then no one's going to die for Toyota. You know, like, you know, right. Like, I'm going to. I mean, they may pay lip service to it being the best car, but it's like, you know, I'll go to my grave. And the weird thing is like, I, you know, even talking just, you know, improvisationally about this is that, you know, when planned obsolescence, you know, became part of the capitalist model, mm-hmm. that, you know, you get a sort of an exception to the faith, you know,
capitalism. Yeah.
Right. You know, you're sort of like, of course it broke. There, you know, you got to buy a new one. You know, it's very rare that you can find something like these are going to last a lifetime. That shit's over.
No.
So that, I think that probably tempers, you know, and, you know, certainly the American faith.
But by the argument that you're making, though,
yeah.
It shows exactly the vacuousness of this position that, oh, well, then if we just get rid of religion, then, you know, we'll be more peaceful,
but that doesn't make any sense. Well, it doesn't make any sense primarily because, you know, and I've noticed this more now, is that by and large, most people are not, you know, in the habit of critical thinking. Now, like, if you could create, you know, and I imagine this was some of the answers that communism was trying to provide, mm-hmm. on some level, is that, you know, this is about, you know, people. You know, so, you know, in order for what you're saying, this rational, almost cynical, you know, belief system to be universal, you know, would require people accept that they're going to die, accept their lot in life, accept personal sort of responsibility for their lot in life and the ability to do something about it in a proactive way, that a lot of that stuff is too many leaps for most people. It's like, why? What, we just want to be taken care of, which I also think is the appeal of authoritarianism. It's like, it may not be democratic, but at least this guy, you know, has some, you know, he has the narrow-minded ability to...
Is an answer.
Yeah, an answer.
Yeah.
Right.
What you said about communism is perfect. Like, how quickly did communism go from a philosophy to a rigid fundamentalist ideology that was responsible for the deaths of tens of millions of people, right? Again, look at the 20th century, right? By far the most bestial century in human existence. The deaths of hundreds of millions of people in the name of religion? No. In the name of nationalism, in the name of socialism, in the name of communism, in the name of Marxism and Maoism and Stalinism.
And capitalism.
Capitalism. These are not religious
That's
movements.
Usually disguised, though.
Yeah.
Capitalism is behind about four of them.
Of course, yeah. But these are in many ways actually devoutly secularist ideologies. The fact of the matter is that religion, like every ideology, is dependent on the individual and the community. You can use it for good, you can use it for bad. The problem is that human beings, because we are tribal, because we are want towards violence, because we are all about in-groups and out-groups, who is us, who is not us, will use God to kill each other, will use the flag to kill each other.
Right, but you forgot about desperate and vulnerable and terrified.
Yeah, terrified. Fear, absolutely. So when I say, look, I'm going to go around the world and I'm going to introduce you to these religions that may seem weird to you at first, I'm going to immerse myself in them and I'm going to show you that there are beliefs behind these religions that you actually agree with,
sure,
that you connect with.
But I think also, like, you know, in defense of atheism and in defense of, you know, that dialogue, that, you know, there has to be, you know, these things are almost eternal checks and balances towards, a globalized, authoritarian existence. Hmm. That, that dialogue has to happen. You know, there's going to be pushback on both sides, but, like, not unlike, you know, I used to do a joke about ultra-Orthodox Jews at the wall, you know, praying in Israel, like around the clock. In my mind, it's like, they have to be there for the rest of us. Or if they one day go, like, we're done, you know, what happens to it? Right. You know what I mean? Like, it's not a belief in them or anything else, but these extremes, you know, afford the moderation, that there has to be something to push against.
Yeah, but I think that push is happening from within these religious communities.
Sure.
You know? And I think that's what gets missed a lot, that people just assume that the extremes and the moderates or the progressives are all essentially in the same camp. And that's like saying that, you know, well, we're all Americans, so we all have to support the president.
Yeah.
Fuck that. No.
Yeah.
The president is destroying the country. And he may say he's doing it because he is patriotic and he loves the flag. I'm patriotic. I love the flag. And for that reason, I'm going to do everything I can to get rid of this guy.
Yeah. Well, no, absolutely. So when you talk, like, okay, so you know, once you start pushing back at evangelicals as a teenager, you know, what is your journey? Because, like, part of the desire to study what you studied and then watching you on this show, you know, approach this thing, you know, with an open mind and an open heart to a certain degree, is that, you know, I have to assume intellectually the drive to study religions or religion in general is some sort of quest for answers, but also a quest to for your own control.
Yeah. Well, so pushing back against evangelical Christianity made me really, really good at religion. So I went to college because I wanted to be a writer.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, well, I'm going to take a religion class because it seems interesting. And I realized I like it and I'm really good at this. But the more I started studying the religions of the world, the more it became impossible to take any one of these religions all that seriously anymore. For the simple fact that what we're talking about is that I suddenly realized, you know, they're basically just different languages for the same exact statement.
Right. And that's something you pull through the series.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so I wanted a language for myself. you know, it was Christianity wasn't going to do it anymore. The symbols and metaphors of it had just kind of failed for me, and I wanted something else.
Why didn't you go with the Baha'is?
I love the Baha'is. Yeah. Absolutely love the Baha'is.
Yeah.
But I was encouraged by some of my professors to be like, well, why don't you like go back to your the faith that you grew up in? And I was like, I don't know anything about it. I know nothing about Islam at all. And so they were like, here are some books. Read about it.
These are professors. You know?
Yeah, these are my professors. Yeah. Priests, actually. Yeah. I went to Santa Clara University, a Jesuit college. So these are like priests who were like,
maybe Catholic priests.
Go back to being a Muslim.
Yeah.
The Jesuits are quite different than, you know,
right.
the other Catholics.
Of course.
But anyway, and I started reading up and I started realizing that this was the language that I preferred. These were the metaphors that I preferred.
Just because of the personal history or that they fell into place?
No, it was really like an intellectual thing. Uh-huh. It was like the way in which God and creator and the relationship between the creator and creation and humanity's place in the world, the way that it's described, the language and metaphors, the symbols used to talk about this thing, you know, called life, rang true to me in a way that the language of Christianity that I had been sort of reared in up to that point didn't anymore. Yeah. And by the way, this is goes back to how we started this conversation, because what I discovered very quickly is that there's a massive difference between religion and faith. Faith, it's mysterious, it's ineffable, it's individual, it's fundamentally a choice. It's as simple as that.
Well, that
there isn't any mystery to it. You either believe that there is something beyond the material world or you don't.
Yeah.
No one can prove or disprove it. You just choose to believe it.
Yeah.
If you choose to believe it, then you have to ask yourself, well, do you want to do something about it? Do you want to experience
that?
Well,
see, I think that that particular valve in the human mind is really what atheists are saying. Like, you know what I mean? Like, don't that choice is not a choice.
And I think the religious people would say the same thing. That's my point.
You know, if you are prone to that, That is a fundamentally exploitable vulnerability.
It
can be, right.
Yeah.
So like,
so can materialism, communism.
No, I get that.
Yeah.
I get that. But that's where you start to find the hierarchy. That's where, like, even in your first show, that Hindu caste system that has existed for centuries, you know, exists because the people that are the untouchables, you know, that is, it becomes a birthright. So that vulnerability of their, you know, their eternal lot generationally, you know, doesn't come up for question, right?
Yes.
You know, maybe a few of them do, but the rest of them are like, just shut up and put the log on the fire, right?
Right.
So what becomes really tricky about that and the way the power structures of religions work and how they're used is essentially that vulnerability and any individual's responsibility to, you know, what they are going to be used for.
Yeah, the way in which faith can be manipulated by religion for often bad things, sometimes good things, but often bad things.
And co-opted by larger systems to
like
do
the
bidding.
Republican Party.
Sure.
Exactly. Or the social structure in India.
Right.
You know, many Hindus would be like, the caste system, that's not a religious thing. That's just some, you know, politically minded form of control.
I didn't know about it until I watched your show. Really?
Yeah. And some people would say that. And some Hindus would say, no, this is a deeply religious thing. It's part of who we are. Who's right? Neither.
But inescapable karma. What kind of fucking sentence is that to put on somebody?
Yeah, exactly.
That, you know, just like, well, you were born into this. You know, your people have been polluted forever with just horrible, inescapable karma. And because of your job, you can't get out of it. You are here to burn the bodies.
When Marx said that religion is the opiate of the people, he was right. What he was wrong about is so is communism, so is nationalism, so is socialism.
Yeah.
All of those things, all of those ideologies are means of controlling populations for the betterment of the powerful and the wealthy. But does that, therefore, by definition, devalue or delegitimize faith? And I say no. Why would it? Because, again, if faith is all about, which I really do believe that it is, a simple choice about how you think of yourself in the universe, whether you think that this is it, or whether you think that there is something beyond this.
Okay, well, I think that is the crux of sort of like my experience watching these things and watching you engage with these people, is that, you know, when you say that it is a personal thing. So that means that, you know, in the moments that you choose to use in the show, when you interview certain people in these different situations, mm-hmm. that, you know, what I found is that there, that even the ones that are prophets or respected leaders, that because you approach them with an open mind and an open heart, that their vulnerability as humans becomes almost difficult to take.
Yeah, I mean, when I was at in Hawaii with that doomsday group. And
yeah, I don't mean difficult to take in that I'm against it, but it's just sort of like, I can see through this.
Yeah. Well, and in fact, with this prophet, Jesus, with a Z that I...
The doomsday cult in Hawaii.
Yeah, in Hawaii. The first time I meet him, you know, he's this like crazy. He's like running around. And I mean, most of that we couldn't never air because it was all about, you know, these like crazy sexually explicit things. You know, he was like talking about the end of the world and about waking up covered in cum. And it was like all this insane stuff. And the next time I met him, like 4 days later, I sat him down and I was like, don't do that again. Don't just talk to me like a human being. And no matter what you think about him...
Well, part of it, I'm sure in his mind, is like, oh, you don't want the show?
You don't want the show. Yeah. That's, yeah. He's like, literally. And what was amazing about that experience is, again, no matter what you think about him, you might think he's crazy. You might think he is getting messages from the God. I personally don't think that there's a difference between those two things. But
of course, there may not be a difference between those two things, but there's certainly a difference between a megalomaniacal person who wants to lead a bunch of other vulnerable people in this existence that he's, you know, deemed utopian. And, you know, like what I felt in watching that is like, this could go bad at any second.
It could go bad at any second.
And I knew exactly what it was. There's like, you know, kind of like, you know, wayward, fragile people that are looking for themselves or looking for something, and they heard about this place. You know, it's not a hostel, but you can hang out there, maybe, you know,
you can hang out there, be part of this group.
Yeah,
it's free, a commune, love.
right. Yeah, those don't end well generally.
Sustainability and also an answer to the end. Like
an answer to the end,
too.
Right, but the whole sort of enviro eco-friendly angle of it.
Yep.
And your comparison to Manson was you know, I thought good, but like, you know, what I found in watching that one in particular was like, you know, this guy has got a good game going, and it's a small game, and it's enough for him, and it seems to be enough for the people that are around him. But it's never going to be thousands of people.
No, but tell me you were not at least a little bit intrigued in that second conversation when he was like, I don't know, maybe I'm crazy. I feel like I'm right. Maybe I'm not. It's so stressful. Like, I'm barely eating anymore. I don't even have insurance. Like, what if one of my disciples breaks a leg? What am I going to do? Like, just hearing him talk like a person for a minute was, I think, you know, extraordinary.
Well, I think that what's interesting that you said, you know, that wasn't on the show, that, you know, and that how much he uses the word fuck and stuff, is that, you know, that's a device. You know, to talk about cum and to talk about fucking and to talk about all that stuff to a bunch of kids who God knows how they grew up.
A lot of them from very strict religious
families. Exactly. So you got some guy, you know, talking about cum and fucking. It's like, what's happening?
And it's religion.
Right. It's mind-blowing. Yeah. So you're like, yeah, you know.
There was definitely, listen, I met a lot of his followers and they all pretty much fell into that same category. Lost, hippie-ish, wayward, disaffected with society.
Looking for somebody to...
Grew up in a very strict religious
family.
If not
abusive, I imagine.
And then came to Hawaii and Utopia. And what I'm trying to do is basically train the mind of the viewer in a sneaky way, right? I'm going to entertain you. Yeah, it's exotic. Yeah, it's sensational. Yeah, it's beautiful locations. And yeah, I'm doing crazy shit, you know? But hopefully... What happens is that you watch enough of these episodes and you start to get what's happening here, which is precisely what you say, is that, oh, there's, you know, there are extreme versions and there are moderate versions. And underneath all of this stuff is a sentiment that I find really familiar.
Yeah, but also,
maybe I have more in common with these people than I thought.
Well, that's the thing that struck me, is that, like, even the ones I watched were The Hindu one, and then I watched the Doomsday one, and I watched the Voodoo one, mm-hmm. and I watched the Scientology one.
I mean, that was one of the most fascinating.
What's funny, because I just talked to Louis Theroux about his
yeah.
doc. Yeah.
This is, you know, this is different, because this is not
no,
about...
No, no, no. Your angle was good.
Yeah. Because what I wanted to do... Look, everybody in America has an opinion on Scientology.
Right.
Okay, but... Few of us know what Scientology actually is.
I actually have the same opinion you do. You know, and it's
no weirder than any other religion.
That, yeah. And it's a young religion, and you know, like I guess the most popular modern American religion to really take was Mormonism. So, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So you know that, yeah, in certain ways that there, yeah, there are tactics and procedures within Scientology that seem particularly inhumane and totalitarian, and mm-hmm. the nature of Miscavige and where he's going with the church and whatever, you know, I think is worthy of scrutiny and
no question
and brutal criticism. But the idea of it not being a religion is ridiculous.
And by the way, that's a perfect example of this divide between religion and faith. So the Scientologists that we interview and hang out with,
yeah.
these are devout Scientologists. They are devout believers in the religion. They zealously follow
the
L. Ron Hubbard.
The ones who have separated from the church in order to honor Hubbard's original plan.
Exactly.
Right.
So they call themselves reformists.
Yeah.
They're like the Protestants of Scientology.
Yeah.
They feel like the problem with the church is that it's been corrupted and bastardized, you know, after the death of L. Ron Hubbard. They loathe Miscavige. They agree. They would agree with Theroux, they would agree with Leah Remini, all the stuff that people, you know, anti-Scientologists say about the church. These guys are like, yeah, that's absolutely true. But that's the church, not the faith.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what I wanted to do was, first of all, tell people that that's a thing. Like, I think people are always freaked out. Like, wait. There are Scientologists who follow the religion, but not the church?
Well, the thing is that most of the time, the way it's captured in conversations, and I can't, you know, say this across the board, but by ex-Scientologists, people who want out, is that, you know, then they were, you know, subject to being victimized by, you know, fascistic tactics to stifle them and to shut them up.
By the way, these guys would say the same thing. I mean... The what we always hear about is from the church and from former Scientologists, you know, anti-Scientologists. This is the first time we hear from Scientologists who don't follow the church. And there are half a dozen of these sects. Now, the church would say they're not really Scientologists. They don't really count. You know,
they call them repressor.
They call them squirrels. They call them squirrels.
But yeah. What's the other one? The bad person, the negative person?
SP, suppressive person. Yeah.
Suppressive person.
And so, you know, the church is very angry about this show, but they don't really know how to formulate their anger. See, the church knows how to respond to Louis. They know how to respond to Leah Remini.
And
right?
The people who want out. But they don't know how to respond to people saying like, no, we're really doing it.
Yeah. They don't know how to respond to a show that's like, no, you actually are a religion. I take you seriously as a religion. It's a real thing. But here's the thing about religions is that they break apart.
Yeah.
And so this is a reformation. And they're like, nope, there's no reformation. There's nothing. Oh, we are the only people who can say who is and who is
and
not
every
Scientologist.
Church, every religion has said that.
And my argument is, yeah, that makes you a religion. Yeah. You saying that legitimizes you as a religion. So they're like, they're completely baffled. They're like, well, we kind of hate you, but we also appreciate it. Yeah, they're you know.
You've heard from people within the church, but on an official level?
On an official level, I have been inundated ever since the commercials have come
and
out.
And the general tone is what?
It's, again, the tone is somewhat confused, you know. At the same time, it's like they recognize that the very fact that this show exists, it legitimizes them as a religion, which mm-hmm. is what they've always wanted. Like,
yeah.
You know, we are a religion. We are a real religion.
Right.
But at the same time, the fact that the focus of the show is not on the church, but on these breakaway sects.
Yeah.
And the
purists.
point of it is that look what's happening. Like this happened, you know, 500 years ago in the Catholic Church, right?
Yeah.
People were like, the church is corrupt, it's inept, and it's taken away Jesus's true teachings. We are the true Christians. Mm. That's exactly mm-hmm. what these reformist Scientologists say. And the church's argument is the Church of Scientology's argument is the exact same argument that the Vatican made, which is no. Only we can say who is a Scientologist. By right. definition, if you leave us, you are not a Scientologist anymore. Here's the fascinating thing, just from like a purely intellectual way. The difference between the Vatican 500 years ago and the Church of Scientology today is that the Church of Scientology has trademarked Scientology.
Yeah.
And so they've copyrighted this material. So, you know, the Vatican could say, oh, you don't get salvation anymore. But the Vatican couldn't say, like, we'll sue you if you keep reading the Bible.
Yeah. Right. You know? Right. If only they knew.
Right. Whereas the Church of Scientology is basically like, we will sue you if you keep saying you're a Scientologist.
Well, that is something funny about what we talked about before, is the nature of business, is that the ritualistic, you know, depth of the Catholic Church knew that they had most people terrified.
Right. Right. Exactly. Yeah. They're in charge of salvation.
Yeah.
You know?
And like, and the most people bought it. Yeah. But now it's sort of like...
Now it's financial ruin.
That's right.
Yeah. Now we'll take you to court.
Exactly. It's a business driven... I don't think the Scientologists have ever, you know, in any logical way, you know, been able to say that the business element of Scientology is, you know, got to be, you know, about 80% of it, even to people that know that are in it.
Yeah. In fact, I say this all the time. I say, like, it's like the perfect... amalgamation of religion and capitalism, right?
That's right.
Salvation, however you define it in the Church of Scientology, costs money.
Yeah.
It just does. And people were like, well, but you give tithes to a church. Right, but your salvation doesn't depend on the tithe.
The other thing that I found interesting is just that, you know, by immersing yourself in these things and actually documenting, you know, your immediate experience with the... ecstatic message of any of these different things you were involved with by being audited and by engaging in that process, by, you know, drinking the Ganges and by, you know, allowing yourself to, you know, be in the circle with the Jesus with a Z and being part of the voodoo ceremony and coming out of it, you know, after you were, you know, in that waterfall, I'm still shaking and whatever, that you opened yourself up. The thing that really struck me and I brought up before was that, all right, you felt the impact of the recruiting tool.
Oh, yeah.
And you understood that, like, you know, I am half into an ecstatic state. You know, that I could see that if I do this three more times, you know, that who knows. But that is the difference in, like, in something like New Age spirituality, you know, which draws from any particular religious disposition or ritual to sort of, you know, create that feeling over and over again without the commitment of a organized church, that, you know, there is sort of like, there's something very telling about that. That all those things that you experienced, those feelings may have been real, but in order to really, you know, serve or be served by the religion, the commitment or the faith, you know, is required. So, you know, to me, it was very interesting about you and about most people who consider them spiritual on any spectrum of the sort of New Age or hippie experience. It is separating ritual from larger systems of belief to feel that relief that you may have felt. And I'm not saying that's bad
difficult.
Or good, but it doesn't do the same thing.
It doesn't do the same thing because, yeah, in the end, well, this is an argument that people have in the religious studies all the time, you know, which is like, can you have religion without community? I mean, is it all about community? I mean, can you say, I'm religious, but I don't ever go to any church. I don't hang out with anybody else who shares my religion. You know, I would say yes, because I'm much more interested in individual faith than I am in communal religion. But yeah, this whole idea of belonging and in-group and the rules and the institution and that these are the things that set us apart from everybody else, you know,
yeah,
whether it's the other church or the other cave.
Right.
All of those things, I think, are deeply a part of that fundamental experience of what it means to say I'm religious.
Right. The tribal thing.
That goes back to that, yeah.
Well, it was great talking to you, buddy.
Thank you, Mark. I really enjoyed this.
Thanks, man.
Take care.
There you go. That was, I felt like, you know, I felt like I worked out on that conversation. And then I ran into him a couple days later down the street. So now that I know what he looks like, perhaps we'll be hanging out down at the coffee shop. I will be at the Fox Theater in Oakland tomorrow night, Friday, March 24th. I'll be at the Moore in Seattle on Saturday, March 25th, and at the Vogue in Vancouver on Sunday. You can go to WTFpod.com/tour to check upcoming dates. I'll be in Austin, Texas next week, and there's more dates there on the site. Oh, do I have time to play? Yeah, okay.
Boomer lives!